This is CliffCentral.com.
What does it take to be one of the world's greatest? Well, working hard every day, continuously, consistently. Famous tennis player Johan Kriek is one person who can tell us all about this. He is a South African-born former top professional tennis player, ATP world ranking number 7. He was the two-time Australian Open champion, also South African Sports Hall of Fame member since 2007. And these days you can find him running the Johan Kriek Tennis Academy as a proud husband and father, and I'm very pleased that he gets to spend a little bit of time with us today. So Johan, first of all, very nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Very nice to meet you, Gareth, on Skype here. So look forward to hearing all about what's going on in South Africa.
Well, you've got such an interesting story here. I mean, you're now a U.S. citizen and have been since 1982, but for a long time you were some something that we could be very proud of in South Africa, and you still are for many people. Tennis in your day was a very different game to the game it is now, but in some ways quite similar. When you think back on those days, do you think you were at a disadvantage being South African, or do you think that it was an advantage in some way?
Oh, that's a very good question. I think that it was very different from today. I think the political thing was way, way more intense and way more disadvantaged for us because I didn't play Davis Cup. I didn't play. We didn't have the Olympics at that time. As tennis was not in the Olympic sports when Kevin Curran and I were eligible to play the Olympic Games, but. Yeah, we right when our careers happened in that 14-year stretch, South Africa was blackballed from Davis Cup, which was a real pity because I think we could have probably done well with it. The political thing was a way, way more stringent. There were areas where we couldn't travel to back in the day. Mm. And, it was a very different political time, political climate. It was difficult to be in America as a South African, and then it was difficult sometimes to even go back to South Africa after I became a South African citizen.
Now, you mentioned Kevin Curran there. You and he were doubles partners. You won Wimbledon senior doubles 4 times in a row from 2003 to 2006. So you're still as fit as a fiddle. That's not so long ago.
I wish I could say that today, but we had a great run. Kevin and I, unfortunately, we didn't play too much doubles together on the tour because we were, he went to college and then hooked up with Steve Denton. Mm-hmm. My old nemesis when I played him in the Australian Open finals twice. So Kevin played with Denton most of his junior career in college, and then also post college career he played with him. And so we played in a senior tour mostly together at the end of our careers, and that's when we picked up some steam. So yeah, we won the U.S. Open a couple of times, and we won Wimbledon 4 years in a row.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, I think that, despite the fact that you'd had this incredible career on your own up to, the 80s and even up to the lip of the 1990s, it's amazing to me that you picked it up a couple of years after in doubles and ended up winning at that level. It's incredible.
Yeah, I was very fortunate. Unfortunately, fortunate and unfortunate. Sometimes something happens really nasty, and then one door closes and 2-3 others open.
Yeah.
Basically my career came to a sudden halt without me realizing it. In 1989, I started to have some elbow problems. In 1989, there was a huge shift in the technology side of rackets.
Yeah.
And we were just basically test pilots for the racket companies, and I was playing with Donne Rackets at the time, which is a Belgian company. Mm-hmm. And Andre Agassi was knocking on the door in 87, and he was playing with Donne as well. And suddenly, we had to string our rackets harder, and we had different grips, and we had a much wider racket frames, and which allowed you to hit the ball harder. But what we didn't realize is that the wear and tear on your elbow at that time over a 6, 9, 10, a year time span, it was really, really bad. So I had severe, severe tennis elbow, which ended up that I had torn my ligament off, my medial epicondyle, and I was beating Chang and Agassi with a bad elbow.
I can remember those matches. I mean, Chang and Agassi, this is we're talking, the sort of the golden years in some ways of tennis, and you're going through enormous pain and difficulty despite that.
Yeah. So I literally, after I beat those guys, I had to have surgery, and they reattached it. And they told me, oh, with rehab and all that and good rest. I did it in September of 1989. And by January, I could still not even brush my teeth. So they said, oh, you're going to be able to play the Australian Open. I said, there's no way. Wow. So it ended up being a very roller coaster mental thing. And I had second surgery a year later to reattach it, torn it off again. So there was a lot of problems, not because I didn't know what I was doing. It was just that I was given the wrong information on the rehab side. So I ended up having a second complete surgery to reattach it again. And that took another 2 years. And then there was another third surgery just to clean up my elbow because there was some loose pieces flying around in there, and you could lock it suddenly. So yeah, I went through a long stretch of real, real serious trouble with my elbow. But you know, within 1993, I was completely retired basically because I'd lost my ranking. Yeah, I tried to make a comeback here and there. Even with a bad elbow, I went from 1600 in the world to 200 in the world in 6 weeks. So I just couldn't handle the elbow issues and the pain, and I just definitely not going to do drugs to keep the pain at bay because that doesn't work long term. But yeah, so then Connors called me in the early part of 93, and he said, listen, you know, can you play? I said, well, I don't know. It's been a few years since the surgery, and it should be okay. I mean, I'm in the gym, I'm doing things, I don't play a lot of tennis. And then I got to the finals. I beat Vilas and Borg in both those tournaments that we started the senior tour with. And then I ended up playing Connors in the finals twice, and my elbow held up. And that was the beginning of the senior tour in 1993 with Jimmy Connors, Borg, and McEnroe. And then we played almost 10 more years on that tour. And it was until Jimmy sold the tour, and then we all stopped. But, yeah, it was an amazing 10-year sort of second lease on life, and we had a wonderful time in the tennis world. Now, Connors' Champions Tour was very different from the Wimbledon senior doubles and stuff. You know, the senior tour was at that time a real tour, and we played flat out around the world, and we visited places we never played in, even on the ATP tour. So it was really fun. It was great to be with these crazy guys. And I had a lot of fun to have a second career, so to speak, after surgeries.
But, you know, it's all the more remarkable that after these surgeries, you entered right back in. I just want to talk about these rackets for a second, because I remember my dad, who just used to play around, you know, for fun, and he had this wooden tennis racket, which now looks like a relic from Noah's Ark. But when you started, those must have been the ones you used, right?
Yeah, I mean, I played my first junior rackets were pretty much Slazenger wooden rackets. And then I sort of switched, just because they look so cool, was a Dunlop Maxfly, which is Rod Laver's racket for many years and many other players. So Dunlop Maxfly, Dunlop was the racket company at the time, and maybe Slazenger was second. But I played with Dunlop Maxflies until I went to Austria, and then suddenly Head Sportswear Head Racket Manufacturing was in Kennelbach, Austria. So when I lived with my coach in Austria, it was literally a 10-mile drive. And that's how I got involved with Head Rackets, and played with Head Rackets for a number of years. I was playing then. And then I switched to the metal red head racket, which was an aluminum racket with a little red throat. So they called it the Redhead, and it was a very famous racket. And Connors was playing with a stainless steel Wilson T2000. So that was the hot thing, was to play with metal. But not many people could play with that Connors racket. It was like, I mean, you might as well just use it as a fly swatter. It'd probably do a better job for most of us. But Connors could play with it and was beating us all. And we were like, how on earth is he doing it? But I couldn't play with that racket at all. My style wasn't the same. But anyway, I played with this aluminum head racket for a number of years, and then I switched to a composite metal racket that was Rossignol. The French ski company was starting to make rackets in Essex, Vermont. And I had some relationship with Vermont at one stage early in career, and that's how I ran into the president of Rossignol in a tennis facility. And the next moment I had a 5-year contract, and I won the Australian Open twice with that Rossignol rackets.
Amazing. It sounds to me also like you guys who played tennis in the 80s, you're all still friendly with each other. It sounds like a little bit of an old boys network. I mean, these guys are all still on your phone, right?
Yeah, but we don't see each other all the time. I mean, I see, I live in South Florida, so I see John Lloyd quite often. I see a lot of the guys that live in South Florida. I see periodically Michael Pernforce, Matt Villander. Yeah, we see each other at events. I just saw Wayne Ferreira last weekend. I was in Houston, Texas, doing a big fundraiser for an entity there. So Chris Haggard, so I see some of the boys. I saw Donnie Fisser as well. So, we're still kind of around. Even the younger guys that came in 10, 12 years behind us, the younger crowd that is also now retired. So we all kind of get thrown into the same bag of mix for doing a lot of fundraising events and pro-ams and so forth. So we do see each other. But, just like in any business, I mean, sometimes you are in business with people for a period of time in your life, and you don't necessarily were really good friends on the tour. You were acquaintances in the same business. I mean, I don't hang with Jimmy Connors every day, and I know him really well, but I don't hang with him every day. He's in California. I have a lot of friends in this area, South Florida, Palm Beach area, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Boca Raton. It's a very heavily packed tennis mecca.
And you're in Palm Beach now?
I live in Palm Beach Gardens, which is just north of Palm Beach, yeah.
You apparently are off to Richard Branson's island next week, which is one of the reasons I was pleased to speak to you before you go. What's that all about?
Oh, my God. It's the world's richest tennis pro-am. Yeah. And I would have to say that besides the tennis, which is fun and fabulous, they've had everyone there except for Roger Federer, so hopefully they'll get him soon. But they had Rafa Nadal there. They had Djokovic there. They had Martina Navratilova. They had all the greats of tennis there over the last 5 years. It's fairly new. But it's on Richard Branson's island called Necker Island. Mm-hmm. He has another small island that he bought called Mosquito Island, and it's primarily his private residence. But, Richard can't help himself. He's such an unbelievable host and entrepreneur and just an all-around fun person, and he loves tennis and golf and sport and crazy kite surfing, and it's basically heaven on earth when you go to that place in the BVI. It is a one-of-a-kind place. He has two sort of omni courts, which is the artificial grass with sand in it, because it rains so often. Sometimes a cloud comes by and blasts you with a rainstorm, and 5 minutes later it's brilliant sunshine and blue skies again. But so he has to have that surface there, but not the perfect surface to play on, but it's the surface perfectly for that environment. But yeah, he's got an incredible event that friends of mine, Trevor Short and Remington Reynolds from Premier Live out of Atlanta, are friends of mine, Americans, that are running this event for Branson. They do a magnificent job, and we got them, Rod Laver, to come this year. So we are flying down with Rod and his lady friend Susan, and we'll be on a yacht with Jewel, the singer, for a few nights. And Sir Nick Felder, the golfer, is going to be there. So we're going to have a lot of stories to tell.
You know, it's interesting to me how many of you guys who have been amazing sportsmen in your life, you connect to some of the most incredible people in the world, not just within sport, but you get to meet these really wealthy entrepreneurs. You get to meet just about anybody you want. I believe you've even played tennis with Donald Trump. Is that right?
Yeah, I met then business icon Donald Trump at Mar-a-Lago many years ago, because a South African friend of mine, Anthony Boole, called me. I at the time, I didn't know Anthony. He was quite a few years younger, and he also played a little bit of tennis college-wise, but he didn't play pro tennis. So he found my number. I lived in Naples, Florida at the time on the West Coast, which is about 2.5 hours from Mar-a-Lago. And he called me and he said, look, this is probably about 20 somewhat years ago. Mm-hmm. And he called me and he said, listen, do you know some players? I've got this fundraiser with Donald Trump's club here at Mar-a-Lago. We'll put you up for free. Can you help me find a few other players? I said, sure. So I called a couple of guys. David Schneider is one of the guys, and Boca Raton, another South African, who is very, very successful in his diamond business here, you can imagine. So David and I got there, and then I've been playing the Mike Milken Prostate Cancer Foundation events for the last nearly 27 years.
Sure, that's incredible. And what did you get to talk to him a little bit? I mean, obviously he didn't have political ambitions, or certainly was keeping them to himself at that stage.
But well, I'm a political junkie. I eat all the stuff up. I find it fascinating, whether it's South Africa or whether it's any part of the world, but especially in America right now, it's pretty ridiculous. But No, I met Donald numerous times when we played at Mar-a-Lago for a couple of years. Mike Milken was the junk bond king, and an incredible story about these people and, how they made their money. And some went to jail and some came out of jail better people and did better things for the world and for the people. Mike Milken is one of those guys. And so I played. I was literally on my way out that day. It was a funny story. I was going home, and I was literally driving out of Mar-a-Lago. And I got a phone call from Anthony. He says, don't go. Where are you? I said, well, I'm just about to drive out the gate. He says, turn around. One of the pros got injured and they can't play. It was like either Murphy Jensen or somebody got hurt. Maybe I overslept. I don't know. So I had to turn around, get dressed in the car in the parking lot, run to the tennis. And they said, yeah, Mike Milken offered $250,000 for Donald Trump to play doubles because he's never seen him play tennis. Yeah. Because no, Donald is a good, President Trump is now a good golfer. I mean, he plays a lot of golf.
Yeah.
And I've played golf with him as well on his course here at the Trump International, and it's a phenomenal golf course. So he's a very good golfer, very good. And so I jumped on the court and they say, oh, you're playing with Donald Trump. I'm like, oh, my goodness. I'm like frazzled, first of all. I'm rushing. And we're going to play four games. And, I mean, we were down, 3-love like in no time. And we were playing Luke Jensen with Mike Milken, who's a fairly decent tennis player, definitely better at the time than Mr. Trump at the time. So I started running my butt off, and we ended up winning. And on the last point, the ball came to Mr. Trump, and he reflexed the frying pan volley at the net. He aimed right. He hit it left, and it went in, and we won. And he says, I knew we could do it, It was the perfect phenomena of his character, as you could possibly explain it. It was hilarious.
He's not even sure how he did it or what's happened, but he's claiming the victory.
Somehow it worked.
Now, I believe we've just had our new ambassador from the U.S. to South Africa appointed, and I think she's just arrived in the country very recently. And she used to be a tennis player. Is that right?
That's what I heard. I have not met her, but I reached out to her just to say congratulations. And, she's moved to she's an unbelievable entrepreneur. She's done well here. She lives. She's a member at Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
But she was a South African born and now American citizen. And so I think she would be terrific for South Africa as an ambassador. I think being close to Mr. Trump and understanding, the situation down there and what's going on, I think she would be a real good ambassador to the U.S. for South Africans.
That's right. Her name is Lana Marks, and she's also something of a handbag entrepreneur. But so you're telling me that she also used to play tennis, and having been born in East London in South Africa, probably knows a little bit more about the country than most.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's a good combination, and I wish her the best of luck, and I really hope that South Africa can pull through some of the difficulties.
Can we talk quickly about your tennis academy, the Johan Cruyff Tennis Academy? Just tell me about that and exactly what you do and who's involved.
Yeah. I've been involved with the tennis academy business or the tennis coaching business now for the last 11 years or so. And when I first started the academy, it was the end of 2006, 2007, I started my academy business on the west coast of Florida. I was at the Longboat Key Club for a while. Within a very short period of time, a few months, I had realized that, to do this right and be in the backyard of the IMG Nick Bollettieri Academy, I had to be competitive and do something different instead of just leasing a facility. And so I planned with a couple of guys, to make a long story short, we were going to build a massive sports academy, not just tennis, but many other sports under one roof. And at that time, the economy was cranking pretty well in the late 90s and into the 2006-07s. It was still going well. Unbeknownst to us, we didn't realize that the world economy was going to tank and that the real estate market in the United States was going to implode, especially in Florida, because there was so much speculation going on. And so we planned a $300 million sports complex, and then it fell flat on its face in September of 2008. And we raised about, number of millions and had to walk away from it. So that was a big, big disappointment. We spent a year and a half developing it. So, so that's been that situation. So I ended up I ended up moving away from Sarasota, Florida, and I've been in a few other cities and running my academy. The problem is in my business, if you don't have your own facility, you are not a master of your own destiny. So I tend to ramp up rather quickly. Within a couple of years, I start making some serious dough, and then things start to go south because people think, well, they can do the same thing. And you know what they don't realize is that I am the juice and I'm the name, and that's why I bring kids from all around the world. So to make a long story short, I'm here in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. It's a small city. It's a wonderful city, one of the best run cities in America. Ernie Els lives 10 minutes away. Louis Westason, Sheryl Schwartzel, I think, may have moved, but they all were here. Greg Norman's kids were in my academy. All the golfers had their kids in my tennis.
Well, it sounds like it's also a bit of a satellite South African compound by the sound of things.
You know, it is. This area, it's a funny area. Palm Beach is, all the old blue bloods and stuff are still there. I think Palm Beach is its own. I think something like 2 or 3% of the world's wealth live in Palm Beach itself. It's insane. And then you have all these satellite towns like West Palm Beach, North Palm Beach. You've got all these little towns that are all connected. You don't even know where the one ends and the other one starts unless you see a sign. And there's about 11 of them. And North Palm Beach is just to the north of us. So, and then Jupiter is a very famous town, and that's where Celine Dion and a lot of people have homes. Tiger Woods has a restaurant there. Michael Jordan has a restaurant there. So there's a very rich entrepreneurial area, and Swedish people here. It's a very international flavor. And then you have all these golfers that live here. I mean,
It doesn't sound to me like you have very many poor neighbors.
I'm a poor guy in this town, that's for sure.
Johan, you're also a member of something I thought this is quite interesting called the Global Water Foundation. What is that all about?
You know, this is a very interesting story. In 2005, when I was in South Africa on business, I knew Bertie Lubner, who passed away, unfortunately, not too long ago. Bertie Lubner is a Johannesburg-based PG Glass company, has been in
that's
27
right. And a huge philanthropist who's yes. set up family foundation. His family foundation has set up amazing charities and plans that help many people with education and resources and all kinds of things.
He was an amazing, amazing man. And Bertie Lubner and I knew each other. And he said, listen, Johan, why don't you come to Cape Town with me as a guest, and I'll and just come and be part of the World Economic Forum and listen in on what these people have to say. And I've never even thought of it. You know, I didn't even know it was in Cape Town. So to make a long story short, I went with a friend and him, and we were introduced to the it was the World Economic Forum on Africa, and in particular as it relates to water. And I was absolutely blown away about what is happening in the world of water and how important Uganda was for Africa's water health, mm-hmm. because it sits right in the middle of the equator. It's a fairly sizable country. So to make a long story short, I said, geez, you know what can I do education-wise? I'm sort of retired from tennis, still playing here and there. I ended up starting the Global Water Foundation. Just a lawyer friend of mine in Naples, Florida says, look, and I'll do it pro bono, and started the foundation for me. And we did a couple of projects. You know, it was just a thought. And my friend who went with me to the World Economic Forum went and we started the foundation together. Minnie Hildebrand, she now lives in Holland. And we ended up doing some projects here and there in South Africa. We provided money for some boreholes. We did some things in Uganda. We did a borehole in Uganda, but that was such an unbelievably difficult thing to do because at the time there was a lot of war in Darfur. So all the boreholes and everything was happening because of the major displacement of people. So that was a difficult one to pull off in Uganda. But my friend, Ms. Hildebrand, had the Minister of Forestry was her friend in Uganda. So we did a borehole at a school outside of Kampala. And so it's, you know, and then we did a pipeline thing. I raised money by selling some of my old Australian Open rackets. I had 25 of them, and it was my 25th anniversary for winning it. So I sold each racket in a box for $2,000, and we raised $50,000, and we did a pipeline in Manta, Ecuador. just because I knew a friend of mine from Ecuador. So we haven't done much with it in the last number of years. My life has changed a little bit, remarried and kids and school and, you know, very busy, but I kept the foundation alive so I can do whatever I want with it anytime I want.
No, it sounds incredible. It sounds also like you keep very busy. How often do you get to visit South Africa?
You know, Gareth, I have to be—I have to say—it's shameful. I haven't been back in 11 years. After my dad passed away in 2008, I haven't been back. My sister lives in George. I have a lot of family in South Africa. A lot of my family also has been dispersed around the world. There's a lot of them in Australia, New Zealand,
right,
Canada, in the U.S. I mean, they're everywhere. So I'm coming back hopefully for the Federer Nadal exhibition in February. So I'm going to be there for that. So I'm really looking forward to reconnecting with friends and family and just have a really great 9-10 days in South Africa.
Well, it's always a pleasure to catch up with someone who's done so much in their life and who's really done an incredible amount of good work as well as successful sport and achievement. So I hope we get to spend a bit of time when you are here, and all the best for the rest of this year.
Well, thank you very much, Gareth. Yeah, I look forward to seeing you there, and we're going to have some fun. I'm bringing some Americans hopefully down there and see this match. It's going to be something else to see Roger and Rafa in this incredible setting in Cape Town. It'll be pretty cool.
That's amazing. Thank you so much, Johan.
All the best. Thanks, Gareth.
Pleasure.
This is CliffCentral.com.